something slightly different. So these are all building on one another. And I'm going to talk to you about the vagaries of designing clinical trials and the different types of ways to design clinical trials and pitfalls that I have run into. And I'll read to you a quote that Francis Collins wrote and Kathy Hudson in this recent JAMA paper from last year called Towards a New Era of Trust and Transparency in Clinical Trials. It's right at the beginning of this article, which was in JAMA, and we can give you this reference later. But this really embodies, I think, why some people in here already have tried to move towards trials and others haven't yet, but might later in their career, which is what happens to a lot of people where they don't go initially with interventional trials but do later on. These trials are also the point at which the biomedical research most directly engages human participants, dedicated volunteers who trust investigators to uphold the higher standards of scientific rigor and ethical oversight. So at some point, all of us want our research to impact a life of a human being lying in a bed who's suffering. And I think all of us realize that delirium is an undignified state for a person to be in. It's something that embarrasses them. It shames them. They feel it's hard for them to talk about the fact that they were delirious. We watch them go through it. We know that they're suffering, and we want to do something that reduces that element of human suffering. So ultimately, whether you're a basic researcher studying music, studying bioinformatics, whatever it is, we want something to get to the end point, which is that human in the bed. That's what Francis Collins and Hudson are talking about right there. Now, the clinical trial is one way by which to do that. And a lot of you who aren't doing clinical trials know that what you're doing is also important. And what you're doing might eventually lead to a clinical trial or might contribute to somebody who is going to be a trialist. I became a trialist right out of the gate because I, as a pulmonary critical care doctor and internist, thought that I had observed something in the ICUs that I could make a dent in, but everybody said, stupid idea, don't do it, and I was just basically too dumb and too stubborn to not do it. But I did have a mentor. I had a mentor who was willing to have my back, and so we designed a clinical trial that worked, and it helped me to get into academics. And just a few years after that was when I moved into delirium search and contacted Sharon, and we began to work together on developing the next version of her CAM, which was the CAM ICU. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a story, maybe take 10 minutes to do this, and then stop and take questions. So I'll try and be brief, and then we'll move forward there. And then after we take questions about any parts of the story or things that I bring up, I'm then going to close by taking you through about five elements of this article that Hudson and Collins published, because I think that what they're doing is they're introducing the new era of what it means to do clinical trials at the NIH. And there's a reason that these new rules have been developed, and Lucy and I were just talking about it a little bit, but there's some good reasons. So back in the late 90s, when I first began to get into academics, I had this idea about getting people off a ventilator sooner, and this is structural about you and thinking about the way you might design a trial. I had, in designing this first trial, basically I was scared to death that I might hurt somebody. You know, you're actually doing something to somebody now, and you might end up designing an intervention that could hurt them. So I remember very clearly sitting over tables and having papers spread out all over the tables, going through the inclusion-exclusion criteria for those trials and trying to figure out what would be the right balance of allowing somebody in versus excluding them so that I could have a lower chance of harming somebody. And really, I was just super scared. I was actually thinking if I get them off the ventilator too soon, they might have a big heart attack, die, or they could have been supported with life support. And so you see, that was a very real concern in my mind. But the main point for you is that you have to, I call this getting on top of the mountain. When you're designing clinical trials, the first and foremost thing that you have to do is get on top of the mountain of clinical data. So you've got to read everything in the literature that's in your area, know those studies backwards and forwards, perhaps even contact the investigators for those studies, because they're going to know things like Sharon and Donna both share with you, kind of inside scoop on some of their studies today that you would never know from just reading the paper. So getting on top of the data, on top of the mountain, knowing what as much as anybody else does about the topic, and then deciding what is safe and unsafe will allow you to perhaps design a clinical trial that you might not have thought of all these little nuances as you're designing it, but this is what happens in a real world as you pay attention to these things. So this first study that I designed, and deliberately picked four studies that are very different, was unfunded. It was had not a single dollar towards it. We did it by blood, sweat, and tears. And there are studies that you can do unfunded with blood, sweat, and tears. I know all of you want to get NIH funded or federally funded in some way, but there are times when you're not there yet, and you're in what I call an investigative meanwhile. And so this first study we did, I was a chief resident in internal medicine, for example. Without a penny, I got my fellows to help us do this, and we got it in the New England Journal of Medicine. So it was a very, interesting story. We saved 2 days off of mechanical ventilators, we cut complications in half, we saved $5,000 per patient, and no money, no grant went into that investigation. So there are studies like that you might end up doing that you're not yet at a place where you can get an actual grant, that you do need to push ahead with an idea if it's the right place, the right time, you have the backing. And I had one mentor, that's all I needed, but one person to tell me this could be done. So the next study, a few years later, I went and got a career development award from the NIH, K23, and also a BEACON award. Back then there were two separate things. So the BEACON was a foundation grant, and now it's an NIH grant, but back then it wasn't. And with those two grants moving forward, I was a very young stage investigator designing the CAM-ICU, that was the program. And I wanted to start doing another clinical trial. But now, because I knew that the NIH would say go away, I thought, well, I want to do this. Where am I going to get the money to do this? Now I needed some money. And so I decided to go to industry. So this was going to be an investigative trial of antipsychotics for delirium and another interventional trial of a drug that's an alpha-2 agonist up against the GABAergic drugs like a benzodiazepine. So I had these two ideas, and I'm deliberately telling you about these next two studies because they still did not involve NIH funding. Here was a time where people were barely listening to anything about delirium in the ICU. We were just coming up with the CAM-ICU. It was totally a non-thing that anybody thought was a real entity, and yet I was ready to go start doing these interventional trials. My first comment to you about deciding when to do interventions is to be very careful that you don't push ahead too fast. Sharon said to you earlier that that she didn't want to design a new tool. She said she wanted to do something else from a research perspective, but she was forced to kind of go backwards and design a tool. So you heard in her own story that she kind of force-fed herself to do something that she felt required, even though it's not originally where she wanted to go. So you have to think about your own timing, and maybe we can all talk about that during this meeting. Maybe in your Q&A, you might have some specific questions in your own story about timing. But anyway, in this particular case, I knew I couldn't get federal funding, so I thought that I would go to industry, and I did. I got Lilly to back us, and I got Pfizer, two separate investigations, to give us what they called an unrestricted investigator-initiated grant. My deal was I didn't want them to have any involvement in the trial. I wanted to be able to design it and do what I wanted and publish what I wanted without them critiquing it all. So I got all that in contract. And they gave us about $500,000 for each of these two studies. And one of them we published in JAMA, and the other one we published in, the other one was published in Lancet ultimately. So these were different types of randomized controlled trials that wouldn't go under federal scrutiny, but we had to go to a different funding source to get. A third type of funding source that we went to was we had a multi-pronged non-pharmacological intervention, and for that one I went to a hospital foundation. I still knew I couldn't get federal funding there. I was too young in my own career. I wouldn't have been taken seriously as a person doing a multi-center RCT. So instead I went to a local hospital. Donna mentioned that you should not always do everything in an ivory tower. Here I felt the same way. I felt like we definitely need to enroll people from private practice hospitals and ivory tower hospitals. So I did this trial at Vanderbilt and at a private practice hospital in Nashville. And then I went outside of went to Pittsburgh and we got the Hospital University of Pennsylvania, University of Chicago, people that I knew well, knew I could work well with, and designed RCTs there. And the only funding for that study was a private hospital foundation. So I thought, in preparing to tell you the key things I thought about designing clinical trials, that I would make sure that you knew that not everything is done with a federal grant. So here's three examples: unfunded, industry, and foundation to do real clinical trials, which were published in Lancet, JAMA, and New England Journal of Medicine. So you can get good studies published in good journals if you design them right, if you're careful about it, and if you consider where you are in your own career and be realistic. By the time that we had done these trials, I was then able to go to the NIH with the second round of antipsychotic study and then say to the NIH, look, I've done this pilot study, you said. It was funded by industry, but now we need to do a phase 3 study. So then we came to the NIH, put in for MindUSA, which we just completed a month ago. And this is a study of a placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized controlled trial of antipsychotics for delirium and critically ill. It's Haldol, Zopresidone, and placebo. And this was about a $9 million R1 if you include indirects and such. And so by that point, I knew that maybe the NIH would take me seriously at that point. But you see, I wanted to go to them earlier, but I wasn't in a place. So you just have to be truthful about who you are on paper and whether or not somebody will take you seriously. So this is a 21-center, multi-center trial through the NIH. Let's call it the old way of getting an RCT in the NIH as compared to what I'm going to go over with you now is the new way. So back when I did it, we put in some pretty interesting clinical trial design charts and site allocation maps and fidelity to protocol approaches in our trial, but the reviewers told me later that they had not seen that sort of thing in the RCTs of the NIH before. They realized that there were way too many types of RCTs coming in and there was no regulation. And a lot of that stuff led to the NIH saying, we need to get this more standardized. And that's what I'm gonna go over with you about five or six things that Colin said. The last thing I want to say, and I promised you I would stop talking and take your questions, was that in designing these trials, there are a lot of things that you have to do to design these trials that you aren't taught in a chapter, in a book, in a classroom. For example, in doing these drug trials, I had to figure out how do you go to the FDA? How do I get an IND? Do I get an IND or do I get an IND waiver? And all of this is takes up a lot of time and a lot of effort. I'll give you some specifics. So for the antipsychotic trial, I figured just some truthful kernels about how these things evolve might be helpful to you. So I was gonna study olanzapine versus Haldol versus placebo. We were gonna go to Eli Lilly. We had just finished a landmark trial that was in the New England Journal for a sepsis drug called Zygos, or activated protein C. So I had some relationships at Lilly. And the neuroscience center at Lilly said, good, we love, olanzapine's good, we'll go with it. Well, we were down to the wire. We had the whole thing planned. It was gonna be olanzapine, done deal. They had a Zydis form that you know that spits on the tongue that dissolves for ICU patients who can't swallow. I thought that was beautiful. And at the last second, what happened was that Paxil went off patent. And when Paxil went off patent, Lilly's stock fell. And when Lilly's stock fell, they said, we're out. We can't suffer any negatives at Lilly, and if your study is negative in olanzapine, then that's going to hurt us. So I was left scrambling at the last second. We were ready to start enrolling patients with no company, no drug, no grant. And so I started going through different antipsychotics, different atypicals, and Pfizer made a Zopresidone, and it turned out, very interesting thing, it turned out that the only human IV data at all for an atypical was with Zopresidone. There was this tiny little study of IV Zopresidone. It wasn't made for IV use, but there was somebody had just chalked up the gumption to give that drug IV with no PDA approval or whatever. And so when I went to the FDA, I said, and it's a very interesting story, I said, I want an IND for Haldol and an IND for this atypical antipsychotic. I'm planning this randomized controlled trial, and this is what I'd like to do. They said, and I had no idea this would happen, I talked to a lot of people, none of them knew that either. They said, well, for Haldol, there's no IV form of Haldol, it's not in the package insert, nobody's ever done an approval for IV Haldol. However, we all use IM Haldol IV, and it's been done for 20 years, therefore, you don't need an IND. We'll let you go. So IND waiver on the Haldol. So we used IM Haldol IV in both of our studies. No IND required. They said, however, for Zopresidone, atypical antipsychotic, Yes, you have to get an IND, and the only reason I got it was that little tiny little study of the IV used in humans that somebody had done. So I actually couldn't have gotten an IND for any other atypical antipsychotic for IV use. If I'd wanted to use risperidone or olanzapine or anything, I couldn't have gotten it. So these are the sort of things you can't plan. You just gotta just mush forward to get there. And now we'll be publishing in 2018 this RCT with these three groups in it. But that's how we went about getting the IND for that study. And then the last part of the story, and then I'm gonna stop, was that the other drug trial we wanted to do was we wanted to pit up against gabapentin and benzos. We wanted to pit alpha 2 agonists, and so for that we got an IND. The FDA package insert was 24 hour use at 0.7 at the max dose, and we said that's squat, that won't work. We have to go way higher than that for a lot longer. So we got the FDA to allow us to go for 28 days at much higher dose. And interestingly, the package insert will never change for that drug. Just because we did JAMA papers that used the drug with that FDA IND, I'm not a drug company, and I don't go to the FDA and try and change the label for something. So that's not my intention in that situation. So even though the drug studies were published and these trials were done, it won't change the package label. People use the data from the JAMA paper off-label after that's released. So all this kind of comes into play. We're designing clinical trials. I should tell you one last thing is that there was a big story earlier this year about vitamin C in sepsis. Some of you might have heard about this. It was a friend of mine who's kind of a whack. He knows I call him a whack. Paul Merrick, very funny guy. But he published this case series of vitamin C in sepsis. He thinks it cures sepsis. And just 4 months ago, after that got really big news and over a million hits on the internet, my phone rang at my desk. And it was a guy from Facebook. And the guy, this is yet another way you can get a study done. He called and he said, look, I heard this thing about vitamin C and sepsis. I'm a career scientist. This guy was in the Institute of Medicine. He said, I've been hired by Facebook to use $10 billion to advance science. And we're interested in vitamin C. We want you to design a clinical trial. We'll fund it. We'll give you up to $30 million to do this trial. So we're now at the tail end of designing a trial for between $25 and $30 million for vitamin C and sepsis with 200 centers, 2,000 patients, and that just came out of nowhere. So there are lots of different ways to get this stuff done, but you have to be careful about making sure that it's safe for the patient and you use good sense about how to move forward. So let me stop, take your questions. Anything is fair game, and I hope that what I've said provide some fodder for conversation, and then I'm going to go through what Francis Collins said are the kind of 5 or 6 new rules about how to design trials and get FDA funding, NIH funding in 2017.
Could you ask that guy to friend me on Facebook?
Oh yeah, okay. I'll do that.
You just got a room full of friends. Yeah.
Tell him I got a study for him.
Okay, so what did I say that kind of bothered you, or what did I say that didn't sit right with you, or that you have another question about designing these trials, please?
I'm just wondering, what's the best way to approach industry if you've got an idea for a project that you think a particular industry might be interested in? How do you initiate it?
The question is, how do we approach industry? I really think we underutilize industry, and I'm a big fan of partnering with industry here. I think what you have to do, and you do have to be careful because you have to make sure you're talking to the scientists at the industry and not the marketing people. So that every good drug company has people in both areas. So you do not want to talk to, you want to talk to PhDs that the company has hired who are there to promote the science of the compounds and not to market the compound. So that's your first tip. Secondly, do your homework. Look at all the people who have a different pharmacological compound and try and figure out who is in a place of need. So we know which company might be interested to play, and that's the second thing. And then thirdly, I would say that out of the successful industry partnerships, which I just described to you, that's maybe 25% of the times I've tried to partner with industry. So I would say the vast majority of them end up blowing up, kind of like the Pfizer story I told you about plans to be. So you're going to have to be willing to take some hits and have some strikeouts along the way, because there's just too many landmines in the area of industry for you to control all of that. But I think that we should partner with industry more often than we do. And you just got to develop very good interpersonal relationships with people. You got to know them by name, have their cell phone number, and develop that. It can't be a hands distance relationship. It has to be a connection.
So what I got from your story is that, you know, it doesn't have to be NIH funding. You can find other grants along the way to get you until you get your R01 from NIH.
Especially, it doesn't have to be NIH. I mean, all of us want NIH. We love the NIH funds. But I'm trying to make sure you know that if you wait for your R01, your NIH R01 for one of these trials, you're probably waiting too long. There's got to be a way for you to approach somebody else, but foundations, industry, you know, internal grants at your institution, to get faster, farther. And none of these big trials like mine, you say, would have been done if I hadn't first developed a real, honest-to-goodness pilot through some other means.
Sure.
Just keep going.
But at the same time, particularly for young investigators coming out of fellowship, starting their careers, the K-23 becomes sort of this validation stamp that we're on the right path. So how do we set ourselves up for eventually getting a career development award and then down to R1?
Right. See, the K-23 is a validation stamp. The VA Career Development Award is another great validation stamp, by the way. I think they're equivalent, really. And you can't tell which one you're going to get, so I think, you know, figure out which one is right for you. But you can't get enough money to do a clinical trial with a K. You know, there's not research money. They're there to support you. There's a little bit of research money. The BSIN has the most research money. The K-76, revolutionary. But to do a clinical trial, which I told you I started two of them when I was a BSIN K-23 person, you're going to have some external way of doing that because you won't have enough money through the K mechanism to do a clinical trial because clinical trials are very expensive. You're paying for people. That's what you're paying for. You're paying for the coordinators, the screening, the consenting, the demonstration, the implementation of the protocol at the bedside for adherence. You're paying for follow-up. I mean, those are huge salaries. So we spend millions of dollars on these trials for the big ones. But even for the small ones, it's expensive. So you're going to have to, I think at your institution, internal K's and definitely industry and foundation. And listen, that's foundation sale. I mean, that here's how that went down. I mean, go to a private hospital and I found a person. His name is Greg Pope. I mean, I know these people are seared into my brain. I say, Greg, you know, here is a public health problem. People are dying. We can do better for them. I got him personally interested from the heart. And then he went and sold it to people at that hospital. And the biggest grant that they'd ever given at that hospital was something like $50,000. And so once I had them totally hooked, like a fish on the line, then I told them, I need $200,000. And they were like, well, the biggest paper given is 50. I'm like, yeah, but I need four times that. So, you know, and no, yes, 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 and eventually it's a yes. So you've got to just work at this stuff. It's got to come from passionate desire to improve the lives of humans you'll never meet. And you can't, you've got to really invest yourself in that process.
What role did your mentor have in this process? I mean, I guess as someone fairly new to clinical trials, it would be kind of good to have, you know, to have someone telling you you're doing the right thing. And it sounds like you had a lot of perseverance, but what did you have to turn to your, I'm just kind of curious, what do you have to turn to your mentor for?
Well, I'll answer your question about mentorship in two ways. One was, what did my mentor do for me and what happened in my office yesterday? Because something like this happened in my office yesterday. So my mentor's name is Ed O'Connor. He was trained at Hopkins. He was Victor McCusick's right-hand man. Victor McCusick is the father of medical genetics. He was an amazing person. He's the godfather of my twins. So we became very close personally. And what he did for me was that there were 82 intensivists at this institution where I was going to do this original trial that was in the New England Journal. And 81 of them said, don't do it, dumb idea, isn't going to work. Ed was the only one. On the paper in the New England Journal, there's only one attendant. He's the senior author. Everybody else is a fellow. So what he did was he stood by me and said, let's do this anyway. Even though they think it's a bad idea, let's do it. He just was stalwart. And he had never designed a clinical trial either. So we were just doing this flying by the seat of our pants. And it was back in a day where, you know, you could try and get this done. But he stayed with me and we roughed the storms together. Now what happened in my office yesterday is a similar sort of thing. I've got a guy a mentee whose name is Ricky Chenal at Vanderbilt. He's an interesting guy. He's a board certified, he's a general surgeon. He's also a palliative care doctor and a PhD in theology. Very interesting combination, don't you think? Anyway, he wants to study early palliative care for dangerous malignancies like, you know, advanced urologic cancer, Whipple's, stuff like that. And people who you go into it thinking you're going to cure them. And because you think you're going to try and cure them, but most of them don't get cured, they get really late palliative care because the surgeons are afraid. So they don't want you to take away their hopes of them. So anyway, he came off this yesterday, and we were going to do this with four groups: head and neck, thoracic, urologic, and GYN. And he came to my office yesterday really upset because he said the urologists are bailing. The urologists say that they, instead of bailing because they don't want to be part of a study, they want palliative care in every patient on their service. So it was a reverse bail. We thought that they would bail because they didn't want palliative care early. But then all of a sudden they became convinced it was the right thing to do, and so they don't want to be in the trial anymore because they want every single patient to get it. So what I had to counsel him to do, which he'll be doing in the next several days, is kind of what I said a minute ago. He needs to go to those surgeons and meet them individually and say, look, we are at an academic institution. I get it that you now think that for some reason you've been convinced that palliative care might be, you know, early might be better, but we have to study this. And here's what I told him. I said, if they think it's a good idea, you need to convince them that it might be a good idea, but that they don't know. And that if it is truly good, that if we just do it here, that won't have an effect around the world. So we have to prove it so that everybody else will be able to benefit. And that way he's going to get those people invested in the process of discovery. Instead, right now, there are clinicians wanting what they want clinically better on the end of one. I said, no. You have to convince them that their end of one isn't nearly good enough because they need the N equal million. And so so I'm sticking with this guy. And he's having trouble getting it designed, and I'm just going to sit there with him and help him go through those trouble spots that aren't in the book. Right, two more, and then I'll go to the NIH.
I just had a point, just to get some of my thought. There are several people here that are postdocs, and another source of funding that we sometimes forget is clinical researchers or startup funds. So, like, as a nurse scientist, I see nurse mentees come to me and say, you know, I'm negotiating this new assistant professor job, and it's like, I don't have a sleep lab that I need, so I can't ask for $500,000 for that.
Yeah.
But what I say to them is, like, you know, you can ask for $50,000 to do that first pilot. You know, and I realize it may not be enough for a large RCT, but I think they don't think about their work.
Yes. So in terms of negotiating your startup packages, I mean, I suppose some of you will be doing that. I'll just try and do two stories. What about me? What about these other people? But so when I came to Vanderbilt, we were there for 1 year. My wife is a pathologist. We came for her. I was her tag along. And Kim was ready to leave and go someplace else. So I went into my internal, my chairman, whose name was Eric Nielsen. He's the chairman, he's the dean at Northwestern now. And I said, Eric, we're going to leave after this year. And he said, you can't do this research just anywhere. I want you to stay here and let's negotiate you a starter package. So for clinical research, you mentioned $50,000. It depends on what you're trying to do. The starter package size may vary. But I'll tell you personal information because I think it's important for you to hear numbers. That day, he told me that he would give me $300,000. And so that was the startup package. And I used every penny of that to pay for research nurses and personnel to get the next set of clinical trials done. That was a huge gift. And I made sure I was a good steward of that money. One of my mentees right now just came on and was organizing his startup package. And I realized that many startup packages aren't quite that large. But it just depends on what institution you're at and what you're trying to do. And we had him go negotiate. They started at 100 for him, and I told him we had to at least double that, so he got 200,000. So that sort of thing with an internal K and a starter package, that allows you to get some research money beyond just your salary dollars. And you have to negotiate that stuff. You have to go up from what they're offering you. And I made him even get a clause to say that if that isn't enough, that there'll be this extra pot of money to get more money from. So I think that's a critical piece. Thank you for mentioning that. Okay, Anne Marie, you had a question?
There's actually two things, but one thing I've noticed about doing research is that there's so many stumbling blocks that come up along the way, and they're just unexpected, and they're often different people, and it's just like getting through that little difficulty, that little difficulty, that sort of, I'm realising you just have to, okay, and it's often a person's approach, you think, well, how am I going to win this person over? I'm noticing that. The other thing is, I find it very hard to deal with money, and to me, changing my thinking about the fact you actually need money to do this is quite, I find it quite challenging.
Okay, so Amory said two things. One is, what about these stumbling blocks along the way that have to do with people? And what about the stumbling blocks along the way that have to do with money? So first off, the people one, I view this as you have to be, I call it, you have to babysit your study. And being a babysitter, what kind of babysitter do you want? Do you want a babysitter who just sits there and watches TV? Or do you want a babysitter who's actually going to engage with your children and pay attention to what's going on? This is real babysitting. And this is paying attention to every single detail of how it's going. And you cannot do these studies like this. You've got to be completely immersed in these investigations, every single aspect of them, and that includes interpersonal skills. So that thing is huge. And the second thing is, like we're about to start, I'm hoping to start a new type of research with our group that will involve a totally new area for me. I will tell you, I'm going to shun any extra titles, any job changes, anything that takes my time away from this, because I want to be completely immersed in the success of this new program that we're in. And that's a really important piece of this. Secondly, so you kind of are not doing it for your career. That's kind of a key piece of this. You might be thinking, how do I get promoted? How do I create a packet for a tenure track approval or something? Well, that will come. Don't make your research about this. Make your research about getting the research done the most beautiful way that you can. And then everything else will happen. But the thing about money, Anne-Marie, is that You have that whole phrase, you have to have money to make money. That's it. You got to get money to do this stuff. Now, I joke that there are people at Vanderbilt who I call them constantly in a grant writing phase. Every time, there's this one person that every time I see her, I say, what are you doing? Writing a grant. I've never heard her say writing a paper. Okay? And I think that what should happen in your career is you should have grant writing phases and paper writing phases. And as soon as you get your money, quit writing grants. Stop it. Now go do your research, and then start writing papers and do your research and conduct your research. But you should not always be in a grant writing phase. That's a very dangerous thing to do as an academician. Ed's nodding his head. You agree, Ed? Okay. Now,
you need the papers to get the grant.
Well, what's the point of the grant if you don't write the paper and get it published in a timely fashion? Okay, so I'm almost out of time. Let me quickly tell you these things. This is fast stuff. And you can all pull this paper. This was in October 4th, 2016. October 4th, 2016, JAMA. And Kathy Hudson is the first author, too. Hudson K. Maybe we can send this out.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so what he does in just two sheets of paper is take you through these sorts of important things. There's an E figure in here which talks about clinical trials and defines clinical trials. It defines, this is on the NIH website, what is a clinical trial? We can pass this out to them, by the way. This is just a super little simple NIH flowchart that they created for what's a clinical trial. But the new way, you cannot do what I did with Mind USA and get an NIH grant for a trial anymore. You have to do it underneath a specific FOA, which is a funding opportunity announcement. So one we just submitted to was a single center interventional trial, FOA. So you have to have a specific funding announcement by which to submit a clinical trial. If it meets this definition, not the green, but this definition here, then you have to have specific funding opportunities. So you have to talk to your program officer, and maybe you'll address this later on. Second thing is that the NIH no longer will have the clinical trials reviewed in just any study section. They're going to have it done in a study section that has specific expertise. And I think that's just fair to you, because you want your clinical trial reviewed by somebody who has specific expertise. After funding decisions have been made, terms specific to clinical trial research will be incorporated into notice of awards to remind awardees of their responsibilities, including timely sharing of research results. Right now, we're doing a multi-center clinical trial in the ICUs funded by the NHLBI. And it was the first time that I experienced the dog on a bone approach that NIH is now taking with this stuff. And if we fell behind by 5 patients a month, they were threatening to shut the thing down. It was way more intense than in my previous clinical trials with NIH. So it is a new day at the NIH about accountability. And the NIH is going to make sure that they can sustain audits. Lucy will talk about that tonight. But there are really good reasons. Part of the reason is the old way was, this is a good investigator, it's a good center, they've had big papers in the past, we'll trust them. But then some people didn't live up to the trust, weren't good stewards of the money, and NIH got burned. So NIH is now going to say, prove it to me. Prove it to me that you can do this and that we should trust you with this amount of money. So that's part of the reason for these rules. The last ones, last points in this paper, IND, FDA IND. They go through quite a bit about the approach in other papers. In this one, it just says, you know, clinical trials protocol templates will be required. You'll have to be talking to them about what's called IHCE6, International Council for Harmonization, Good Clinical Practice Guidelines. So you're going to have to get your ducks in a row. Stuff that I kind of learned on the job, there's now more structure to figure out. Next one is IRB. There's going to be, instead of, in the past, we would have multiple IRBs all over the country for all these different sites. It's a total disaster when you do that because we will get approved at 5 centers, and the next 5 IRBs will say, no, we don't like it, and you got to go change the protocol for the ones that are already approved because the other 5 didn't. So that's out. Now the NIH prefers one single center IRB for the whole trial. And so that's, there's more than that we can talk about in this one talk, but the approach should be a single IRB. .gov, you're going to have your clinicaltrials.gov filled out before you get started, or they say at the maximum 21 days after the enrollment of the first patient. Clinicaltrials.gov, I mean, this is a thing to point out that's important. You won't learn this in a book either. Clinicaltrials.gov is for what? Clinical trials, right? That's why the NIH created clinicaltrials.gov. And if you talk to somebody at the NIH, they're going to say, this is just for clinical trials, right? So I've always been doing observational cohorts the entire time. We've been doing side-by-side cohort studies in clinical trials for the past 20 years. Guess what? We put all of our cohort studies in clinicaltrials.gov. Okay. Why? Not because of the NIH. Because the NIH says it's just clinical trials. But guess what? The journals want it in clinicaltrials.gov. So you put everything in clinicaltrials.gov if you want it published in a journal that requires clinicaltrials.gov. Now, the interesting thing is that it matters in terms of the closure of it. So, for example, in our brain ICU study, which is totally at clinicaltrials.gov, it wasn't a clinical trial, we don't have clinical trial results to put into clinicaltrials.gov. So NIH says, well, you're supposed to finish this project, but that only counts for the clinical trials. So in summary, I'm talking fast, trying to get the next speaker up here. Okay? All right. Put all of your real studies in clinicaltrials.gov, whether or not they are a trial or a cohort study. You will only put the results of a clinical trial into that website, and it's pain in the butt. It's cell by cell, and it's at the very laborious. So somebody said, why wouldn't you put the results of the cohort studies in the clinicaltrials.gov? Just because I'm not going to spend the time to do that if it's not required. It was not an actual clinical trial. So I don't have any data in clinicaltrials.gov from our brain ICU cohort study. It's not required, it would take a lot of my time. Go read the paper. But for the trial, we have to finish that. Publish quickly is the last thing. And the last thing I would say is that now, for the clinical trial grant that you're going to go under your FOA, you're going to have what's called an R60. You've got two phases of it, R61 and R33. So in the one we just submitted last week, we have which is NHLBI. You have the R61 is the first year of your clinical trial. So on a timeline that you have, you know, a figure in your grant, it's going to show year 1 through year 5. Year one is going to be your R61. They used to give you planning grants to create time for your RCT. Now the R61 is the planning grant. It is the first year, and then the R33 is the years 2, 3, 4, 5 to complete enrollment and conduct of your trial. Those are the main things I thought you should just be aware of. We can unpack more of that later on. I appreciate your attention to all this, and let's move on to the next person. Thank you.